This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. At the age of 14, most kids are pretty busy feeling insecure about themselves and clumsily figuring out their place in the world. But in 1968, 14-year-old William Henry Curry was saddling up for a performance that would set him on a course to be one of the most accomplished conductors in America. He was playing the viola in a youth orchestra when his music instructor tossed him the baton and told him to conduct, and he did. And he did very well. And it was a dream come true for an adolescent boy. Nearly five decades since that first performance, William Henry Curry is still as passionate and enthusiastic about finding the most compelling ways to perform music and lead musicians toward realizing their goals. Maestro Curry has conducted more than 40 orchestras, including appearances with the National Symphony Orchestra and the Los Angeles Philharmonic. He's a composer, a Grammy-nominated conductor, and in his 19th season as resident conductor with the North Carolina Symphony, his 7th season with the Durham Symphony. Maestro Curry, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me, Frank. It's a pleasure.
So let's find out about your that first time conducting. I really want to hear that story. But what got you interested in this kind of music to begin with?
Well, we in my family were at best a lower middle class family. There was no phonograph in the home. There was no TV in the home until I was about 5 years old. This is when about 87% of the American public already had a TV. But you may remember that back in the day, even the lower middle class and all the way up had a piano in the home. That was the entertainment center. My parents were born before radio was invented, but everyone could play piano by ear. So we didn't have a piano, couldn't afford one. But whenever I would go to my parents' friend's house, I would immediately go to the piano. And they tried to get me involved in conversation. Billy, what'd you do in school today? Nothing. Can I go to the piano?
Uh-huh.
And then I'd start to, bang on the piano to my heart's delight. And it must have broke my parents' heart that they simply couldn't afford a piano and lessons. Now, later on, eventually my parents broke the bank and bought a lovely spinet for me. But it was only in sixth grade when finally they put into our all-black grade school an instrumental music program that I began to play an instrument. And, of course, very badly at first. It takes a long time to be able to express your feelings on an instrument. But eventually, when I was able to connect notes to music to feelings, then I fell in love with classical music around seventh grade.
This is Pittsburgh, right?
Pittsburgh, yes. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The instrument was the viola? Did you start out on the viola?
I started out in the clarinet, and then the viola was my true love, and I played that in orchestras.
And were you dedicated? I mean, did they have to push you to practice, or you didn't have any trouble?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
No, I did not like to practice.
Okay.
I tell all young people, look, it takes 1 year before it becomes fun.
Mm.
And then I had the light bulb over the head moment where I could connect the notes to feelings, and then I didn't mind practicing to make these wonderful things perfect.
In those early years, did you know the difference? Did you know there was something missing? I'm hitting all the notes, but this ain't music. I mean, could you feel that? Because I think early on, it's hard for a young musician to know there's something beyond what they're playing right now.
No, I didn't have any sense of that at all.
Yeah.
And I certainly didn't know when I played even a wrong note.
Hmm. Yeah.
So, you're stumbling, you're crawling, and then finally you're walking like an infant, and then it becomes exciting.
Yeah, was there a moment when you played music, that first moment? Do you remember it?
Very much so. There were two moments. I think I was about 13. I was playing viola in a youth orchestra, and we were playing Wagner's Overture to Die Meistersinger. And all of a sudden, I had an out-of-body experience. Mm. I can't quite describe it. I felt like I was floating around the room, and that had never happened before, reading Mark Twain or watching TV. So it was unforgettable. And then another moment, I was playing the viola, and I said, wait a minute, I can talk on this instrument. I was a painfully shy, antisocial kid, and all of a sudden I had a means to express what was trapped inside.
Wow. And this is very early, 13, 14, and this is when you encountered Eugene Reichenfeld, right?
Right. He was my first viola teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Now, mind you, he's going to an all-black grade school, Jewish gentleman, just turned 50, whether he got assigned to that school or whether he thought that this was his mission in life. But he saw that I was absorbing music rapidly. And so he kept giving me orchestral scores, conductor scores, and recordings, and really mentored me.
And then, and was he the one, the reason that you became a conductor?
I would say the reason I became a conductor was that I was so inspired by Leonard Bernstein's Young People's Concerts on TV. I thought that was just really magical how he saw me as an equal, even though I was only in seventh grade. And you look back at these DVDs of him speaking, and yes, that was Leonard Bernstein. Everyone is equal. He may know more than you about this subject, but he's delighted to share it with you. But I was very lucky in that Eugene Reichenfeld was also a conductor. And he had about three community orchestras in the Pittsburgh area, and he was a conductor of the local high school orchestra. So it was immediately after a lesson, he said, Bill, I'm going to let you conduct my orchestra next week. And I said to myself, how does this man know about my secret dream? My ultimate fantasy is to conduct. I had never mentioned it to anyone, never said it out loud. I said, that's wonderful, but I don't know how to conduct. And he said, you know, you cannot teach conducting. You're either a born conductor or you're not. And we'll find out next Thursday. So I went home. I said to my dad, I'm conducting next week. He said, huh? And yeah, I'm conducting next week, Mr. Reichenfeld's orchestra. He said, you can't conduct. He said, well, you know, I'll get up there and I'll do the best I can. He said, that's how his dad taught him how to swim. He threw him in the pool and said, swim, boy. Now, as far as the basic diagram of conducting, it's very simple. Anyone can learn how to do the technique, as it were, in about a minute. But there is something to be said about you're a born conductor or you're not. And I don't quite understand it. I've known musical geniuses, for instance, at the piano or violin. And after 20 years, they couldn't do what I was doing in 6 months. So the next week, here I was conducting this adult orchestra. And I'm sure I was terrible, but at the end, I couldn't stop smiling. I felt that I was at home, finally. And he said, and in 4 months, you'll conduct on my concert.
I am talking today with Maestro William Henry Curry on the state of things. He is the resident conductor of the North Carolina Symphony Orchestra. That was an all-white orchestra, mostly white
orchestra?
Yes,
it was. Yes.
Was that intimidating? What was the racial dynamic at that point intimidating to you? You're young. You're 14 years old.
I wasn't thinking of that at all. I was oblivious to that, absolutely oblivious. And, of course, musicians are something like athletes. If you can do the job, I don't care how racist they were, you know, if you can do the job, you're in. I remember being seeing the first woman conductor. Now it's not, you know, anything unusual. But back in 1973, I think it was quite unusual. And as this woman walked to the podium, I could feel every man in the orchestra kind of get stiff and uncomfortable. And yet, by the end of page one, and it was... what was her name? Judith Samaje. Judith Samaje, the late Judith Samaje. By the end of page one, we were all thinking the same thing. Send all the men conductors home and let this woman conduct. She was unbelievable. And I was very lucky in that she mentored me. And she was very, very helpful.
You know, you talked about your father comparing your first conducting experience to his first swim. But the thing is, if you throw you in the pool, only you drown if it goes wrong. But the whole orchestra goes down with you.
Good.
How do you think you did? How do you think you did that?
It couldn't have been terrible because he assigned me to conduct on a concert that very evening.
So then the second and third performances, I mean, did you have the sort of the sophomore jitters? Okay, the first time, no expectations. But now I've actually done this once or twice. Did it get more difficult in those?
As a child, I knew no fear.
Wow.
None. That comes later on in your mid-20s, where stage fright and indecision. But he was a very brilliant gentleman in that he knew, I will let this young person choose the repertoire he conducts. Because if you have a deep love for the music you're conducting, you forget about the gestures, which is what you must do as a conductor. You must forget about what you're doing. You just must feel the music and communicate what you want to the musicians. But it's like if you ask a centipede, which leg do you move next? You know, then all of a sudden they can't move.
Right.
And it's the same thing with conducting. You have to free yourself and just be the music.
But look, the way a conductor can do that is because they are so intimately familiar with this music. They know every note, every movement, every variation. You're 14. How familiar were you with these pieces?
Well, you have the score in front of you. Yeah. You have all the parts, the first flute, the second flute, et cetera, et cetera. And the thing that people don't understand is the amount of preparation that goes into conducting. Of course, it's fun. And, of course, it's a great emotional outlet and all that. But you have to learn every line of every part. So once you have done that, then you have the right to stand on the podium.
And your head, I would think, has to be in two places. On the one hand, you have to be anticipating where you're going, but also you have to have a close ear on what's happening now to make sure everything is where it belongs in the moment. And then I know precisely where I'm going.
Well, that's a very good point. And a rehearsal is, in a sense, the most complicated part of the conductor's process, in that when you're conducting, you're listening. At the same time, you're listening to what's wrong.
Right.
You're thinking how to correct it. You're thinking of when to correct it and what words to use and then where to go on from there.
Today on The State of Things, we are talking with the resident conductor of the North Carolina Symphony and arts director of Summerfest Concerts, William Henry Curry is the maestro with me today. He will. We've asked Maestro Curry for a playlist of music that he considers essential. You can hear those songs at our website, stateofthings.org. One of those pieces we'll hear right now is Wagner's Parsifal, and you will hear that as we close out this segment of The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. There's more ahead. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, today talking with William Henry Curry in his 19th year with the North Carolina Symphony. You were talking about that first experience conducting an orchestra. Your father said, look, you're not ready for this. How supportive were they of you when you told them what it is you felt like you wanted to do?
I, of course, had great parents, and, you know, whatever my bliss was, they wanted me to follow that. No one ever said there's a glass ceiling. No one ever said you're too young to do this. You know, let him do it was everyone's motto.
So you did that. And also you said you got a lot of encouragement from your mother as well. She was quite influential.
My mother was the dominant parent. She was the one that introduced me to the joy of reading. You know, my idea of a good time when I was in second grade was to memorize the dictionary. She was the parent that taught me that, oh, yes, Mark Twain, Dickens, these people are for you. So my first love was reading, and that came from my mother. And then she introduced me to music. She said, this is Offenbach. This is light music. This is Gershwin. This is Porgy and Bess. I saw a live performance of this in the Stanley Theater in Pittsburgh. And of course, it's an all-black opera, virtually, but they made all the blacks sit in the balcony. This is Pittsburgh, 1942, circa. So, but she just was the greatest mom ever, and she was the person that oversaw my grades, and they were pretty good until I discovered music. And then, you know, I said, I don't need this. I don't need math to be a conductor. And, yeah, she's still quivering in her grave over,
she
over
didn't
my
agree.
Math grades.
She didn't agree.
She did not.
Well, did they sort of hold it over your head? Look, no more music until those grades come up. Or how
yes. Oh,
come?
Yeah. We had a climax with that.
Yeah.
You know, I was held back from playing in a concert over a grade, and you know, bad mom. And,
oh no, good mom.
Know, so,
good
yeah,
mom.
Exactly.
As you well know now.
Right.
So now talk about so those first experiences. You're very young. You're 14. You're going to pursue a career in this. When did you get your first job? Tell us about that.
My first job, I was at the Oberlin Conservatory as a student. And Lorne Mazel, the late Lorne Mazel, was the music director of the Cleveland Orchestra. And the Cleveland Orchestra came to Oberlin campus to do a concert. It was unforgettable, Mahler Symphony No. 5. And my roommate was with me, and he said, look, we should go down to Mazel's dressing room. I said, well, I'm too shy for that. He said, look, we have an entree. We had both played in the Pittsburgh Youth Symphony, and his mother was the director of it, not the conductor, but the director of the whole thing. And we'll talk about his mom and, you know, Pittsburgh and all that, where he grew up. So we went backstage, and I talked to Mazel about the Mahler Fifth Symphony. And I don't know what I said, but it must have been fairly lucid, because the next day he called up my conducting teacher and said, you know, what's this kid Curry like? I was a sophomore then. I was 19. And he said some positive things. So I want him to audition for assistant conductor of the Cleveland Orchestra. So it was an incredible process, which I won't go into now. You had to show him an original composition. You had to play the piano. You had to sight read some things on the piano. It was remarkable. But he let me conduct part of Beethoven's Symphony No. 2. And afterwards, some of the musicians found me in a dressing room. And they said, you know, you are green as grass, but you should stick with it. Well, fortunately, I did not get the job, because I would have been swamped by it. I wasn't ready for it. But there was someone in the audience for that audition who was a conductor, and his sister was the manager of the Richmond, Virginia Symphony. And he gave my name to her, and a couple years later, when they were looking for an assistant conductor, he gave my name to her. So in the beginning of my senior year, I was asked to audition for that job, and they gave it to me. And I said to my conducting teacher at Oberlin, I said, well, you know, I'm not through with my college education yet. He said, I've had 10 students in 10 years. None of them are working as a conductor. So that pretty much cinched it for me. Now, I'll tell you, if I can, the conclusion of the story. I went down to Richmond to be assistant conductor. And then I got there and they said, we're not going to give you a title. I said, what do you mean? Said, well, your predecessor was also from Oberlin, and he didn't work out very well. Now, I had to buy that. I had no choice. I moved all my stuff, and I later found out after I left Richmond that it was because I was black, that some people on the board of directors said, we're not going to have a black male authority figure that's on the conducting staff of this orchestra. Fortunately, I didn't know that at the time. Mm-hmm. So at the end of my first season, I'm playing viola in the orchestra, and the piece is Beethoven's Symphony No. 9. And the conductor doesn't look very well at the dress rehearsal. And I said, oh, I wonder if this is going to happen. I remember at midnight thinking, if he's sick for the performance tomorrow, they'll ask me to conduct it, even though I'm not really officially here with the Richmond, Virginia Symphony. My hand to God, you know what happened. At 8:30 in the morning, Bill, the conductor's sick. Have you ever conducted Beethoven's Symphony No. 9? This is, of course, the most challenging symphony ever written, and inarguably the greatest symphony ever written. And I said, well, yes, of course I've conducted it. A lie.
Way to go.
And, well, you're on tonight at 8 o'clock without a rehearsal. And I was 21. A lot of people have started their careers with filling in at the last moment, but no one has ever begun with the greatest and most difficult symphony ever written.
Were you terrified?
Absolutely, totally confident.
Confident.
You know, because look, let's face it. This looked like it was coming from above. The big man up there is helping me with this one. And by the way, the executive director said, and by the way, we have to say something to the media about you, so we're giving you the title of assistant conductor.
Oh.
Congratulations. Well, the performance went beautifully. Yeah. Though I do remember someone in the orchestra saying before I went on, you know, I wouldn't want to be in your shoes for anything in the world. But I was totally without, I was a Siegfried of conductors.
How do you think it went?
I listened to, in fact, a recording of it a year later, and it was a beautiful performance. I mean, you can imagine the orchestra, the chorus, the four vocal solos, they were all pulling for me, and everyone was focused because what's this guy going to do different than what the conductor had been doing for the previous 4 weeks? So it was, everyone was concentrating.
Come on, maestro. It's four notes and only two tones that start that whole thing off. It's not that hard.
Well, that's what the general public thinks.
I guess it goes on after that, right? There's more. There's more in those four notes.
There's more?
What's the difference? You said, you know, you're born a conductor or you're not, and that's your mentor told you that you have always felt that way yourself. But there is something you learned. They initially, you know, you met an orchestra and they said you were green. What is it that you learn? What do you bring to it if you're a natural that you don't have straight out of the box?
It takes forever to become a decent, let alone a first-rate musician. I still see myself as a perpetual student. Mm-hmm. It looks like it's easy to do. You know, I have a young friend who assumes that you don't have to read music to be a conductor. That's because he's seen conductors on YouTube that didn't have music in front of them. Mm. And, you know, everyone looks like they're having a great time, waving their hands in the air. But, no, it takes these masterpieces. Most of them are inscrutable. They don't unlock their secrets easily to everyone. And so you're not only do you have to be a decent musician, you have to be somewhat of a psychologist. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're working with a 50 to 100-piece orchestra, and these are all separate individuals. And so you lead by being respectful and being very prepared and being very much in love with the music. And that will take you far.
When you say inscrutable, I wonder, that makes me wonder how much room there is for interpretation and how much you can bring, how much of yourself you can bring to this, or what kind of research you would do if you're trying to remain faithful to what you think the composer had in mind, how you do that, what kind of research you have to do.
Well, first of all, we talked briefly before the formal interview about, for instance, I heard a professional actor say to be or not to be in 12 different ways once, and they all had 12 different meanings. And it's the same thing with music. The words or the notes are there on the page, to be or not to be, but to be or not to be, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
It's your job to unify the composition. Everyone has to be on the same page as to the meaning of this. Take, for instance, Beethoven's Fifth. Ba-ba-ba-ba! Okay, that long note is a fermata, which means it's supposed to be held. Now, it doesn't say how long that note is to be held. What, 2 seconds? An hour? I mean, you know, it's indeterminate. So you have to figure out all these answers to the questions in order to make it say something. So it is a narrative, a story.
It is a narrative to you.
Music. For me, all music has a hidden story, and sometimes the story is specific, and it is known.
I mean, is it a story that you could sort of tell people? When you say that, do you mean that it has a kind of a logic in the way stories have logic, or is there an actual narrative, kind of beginning, middle, and end for you?
I like how you say the logic of the structure of a story,
yeah.
A beginning, middle, and end, happy, sad, triumphant, depressed, whatever. No, I don't think of here the princess goes into the garden and all that.
Okay.
But definitely, you know, when I compose, it's all about it telling some kind of logical narrative.
And that means that all of these notes are in relationship and this whole piece is all related, so that how long you hold that fourth note is a lot depends on that. And it's much of the rest of the piece hangs on whether you held it for a long time or a short time, because a lot of the cadences and even some of the valences where you put the emphasis is going to go back to that first choice you made it four notes in.
Exactly.
Am I right about that?
Exactly.
And so musicians have to know about that, and you have to have their confidence. What about that, building the confidence of the orchestra? Do you do that just by showing up and knowing your stuff, or are there other things you have to do to bring all of those people along?
An orchestra judges a conductor within about 1 minute, and sometimes a shorter time than that. They want to see that you can, with your arms, give them something. Communicate the message and the exact tempo of the music. Now, beyond that, everyone will have their own opinion. Some people will say this conductor is too emotive. This conductor is not emotive enough. You know, this one charges is too hard. This one is too easy, et cetera, et cetera. But what they want, or if I can tell this story, I talked to a bass player in the Boston Symphony once, and his favorite conductor was Leonard Bernstein. At the end of his life, Leonard Bernstein could be a rather indulgent and difficult person at a rehearsal. Always a half an hour late, there'd be a cigarette tray, maybe even some booze, you know, around the podium. And but this man said, whenever he approaches, that is, whenever Bernstein approaches the podium, I immediately become inspired because I know this man this day might remind me of why I wanted to be a musician in the first place. If you think of the life of a professional musician, we have a thing called a service. A service is either a concert or a rehearsal. You have so many services a week. After years and years and years of too much playing and not enough reflection about this playing, it can become a service, you know, a gig. Mm-hmm. And you don't want it to be a gig. You want to be reminded of the electricity and the love you felt when you were 14. That's why you wanted to play the bass or the clarinet. And for the inspiration, it's not going to come on a rainy 10 a.m. It's not going to come from the second oboe or the third percussionist. It's going to come from the conductor who must somehow get rid of his own ego. That's extremely important. You know, they all know that every conductor has an ego the size of a horse's whatever. But you must impress on them, look, regardless of my idiosyncrasies, I am in love with this music. Mm. I respect you. We're a team, and we're going to make this wonderful.
That's an interesting trick that you, and I hadn't considered it before, but it is a kind of a trick, isn't it? You have to have enormous confidence. Call it what you want. Call it ego. You have to be confident. You have to be convicted that this stuff is important and convey that. At the same time, you can never be more important than the music. And so that becomes a bit of a trick, doesn't it, to get out of the way and yet have enough confidence to stand in front of all those people and say, I know this music.
Well, yeah, that is the balancing act because you know, my wanting to be a conductor had everything to do with a light bulb over the head moment when I was about 15. And I heard a recording by Otto Klemperer of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Now, of course, I had heard numerous recordings and performances of Beethoven's Fifth, but this was magical. This was much more noble and majestic and meaningful than every other performance. And I said, I want to be the person to bring out the best of this symphony and every other symphony. So it began not just as expressing my emotions, but as a life of service. And so when I get in front of an orchestra, it's not about me and my own personal wishes and desires. It's that I've studied the score. I believe I have an interpretation that everyone can buy into that is credible. And you're not playing for me, you're playing for Beethoven.
I am talking to Maestro William Henry Curry today on The State of Things. He is resident conductor of the North Carolina Symphony and conductor for the Durham Symphony as well. How much do you have to know, or does it matter that you know anything about the composer? Do you bring that biographical knowledge to this, or is it all in the music?
There are different schools of thought about this. Toscanini, my ultimate conducting hero, said to do the Eroica Symphony, you don't have to know anything except the notes. For me, knowing the composer's character, what he was doing at the time when he wrote the piece means a lot to me. And it has always informed my interpretations. And it may be minor, it may be major. It's hard to parse these things out. But yes, I do it. I read letters from the time, and I think you have to know a composer's entire output to better understand his style.
Also, the context, I suppose, the historical context, that's always been interesting to me to know kind of what was going on culturally and politically to see these changes in the music. And yet, this music continues to speak to us today within our own context. What do you think gives this music its lasting value?
That is the unanswerable question, why something written in 1600 could still be relevant. Music is a miracle. And I believe in God. And I believe there possibly also is a God of music. I know that every person that creates feels they're not alone in a room when they are creating. When I compose, I feel something is helping me. And I'm sure you've had moments in a zone when you were writing and something just happened to you. And where'd that come from? Now, you sleep on something and the answer is solved. So it's magic and I feel like I'm the luckiest person that ever lived sometime because here are these vast, complicated pieces that I'm able to appreciate. You know, people talk about a bucket list. Well, it's just incredible that people go to the grave without understanding Beethoven Symphony No. 9. Or you were talking before about Beethoven Piano Sonata No. 28. That has enlightened you and changed your life in some ways. I could tell by the way you spoke about it. So this music is for everybody. And yet we know that it's perceived as being elitist and an ivory tower kind of thing. And
how
this
do we
is
change
the agony
that?
Of
it
my
is
existence.
The agony and the sorrow and the grief. This music is stunning. It is illuminating, and yet it has been associated with a kind of class, and people just don't want to hear it. What do we do about that?
I think that you have to get young people to classical music at a very early age. You know, the North Carolina Symphony has been doing youth concerts for free youth concerts for about 50 years. And these have been for grade school kids. Now, why don't we do concerts for junior high school kids? Because we've lost them for a few years at that point. They give in to conformism. And so it's only around the end of high school or college that they can think for themselves again. But a kid knows when something is exciting, and it doesn't matter whether it's by Mozart or whatever.
And you get these kids composing music, and when they see that they could actually make that music with just a few instruments and a couple of different parts at the age of 5 or 7, that's when you'd have them hooked.
I'd like to think that the history of classical music will be changing during this era because kids have access to all these electronics where they can compose, create their own sensations.
We're going to take a break and talk about your compositions when we return. Maestro William Henry Curry, conductor of both the North Carolina Symphony and the Durham Symphony, and our program will continue. We've asked Maestro Curry for a playlist of music that he considers essential. You can hear the songs at our website, stateofthings.org. Right now, Bruckner's Symphony No. 8, essential for the maestro. Let's listen. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, we are meeting Maestro William Henry Curry. Maestro Curry has conducted some of America's finest orchestras and symphonies. He is the resident conductor of the North Carolina Symphony and conductor of the Durham Symphony. And just in that break, you told me the piece we played out of that last segment, Bruckner Symphony No. 8, was your Mount Everest. What do you mean?
I've never conducted the work. It is probably the longest symphony ever written. It's massive. It says everything about life. And to me, Bruckner is one of those sacred composers in that when I listen to his music, I am convinced of the literal existence of God. And so that's a very special relationship if a composer can bring that certainty to a person.
What is it about that music? What is it that makes you certain there's a God when you hear?
Well, it is. Everyone will agree when they hear it, whether they like it or not. This is music that is attempting to describe God, the most noble things, the cosmic things. To me, it's a total success, the best of his music. To other people, it's tedious and long-winded and pretentious. But to me, I hear the voice of God in his greatest moments.
So what would you say you haven't conducted this? I mean, that sounds like a real challenge if you have that kind of reverence for it. Would you approach it any differently than another piece? How would you approach that? And what are the challenges in conducting that piece?
Well, first of all, it's sort of like I saw an actor, Brian Dennehy, talking about, and he's probably 70, and he said, I have one more challenge left. It's to do King Lear. And he said, and I'm terrified. I'm always terrified, even if it's an easy play. But this is taking on a challenge that is almost insurmountable. And I've always loved challenges. And, of course, the secret to any kind of performance I would have, if it were good, is incredible preparation. I mean, you wouldn't dare to conduct a work like this without 2 months and nothing else but the 2 months of studying this work.
See, the good thing about music is no matter when, no matter what the piece is, I suppose, you can save it to the end of your career. So if an actor wanted to do Hamlet and they get to the end of their career, they're in trouble. They better have Lear as the last thing they do,
right?
Unless they don't live to a ripe old age. Talk about composition. You have composed some pieces, including Eulogy for a Dream. Tell us about that piece.
I was 14 years old when King was assassinated. And I saw the TV, like millions did, live on TV. And what I remembered was the solemnity of the occasion, the sadness of it, and how people weren't crying. There was a numbness, a sadness beyond tears. And that stuck with me. And then fast forward to around 1994, I'm in New Orleans. And I'm coming to grips for the first time with my life as an African American. You mentioned when I was a young conductor, here I was conducting an all-white orchestra. It didn't mean anything to me. I thought being black is an accident of birth. Now, here I was in New Orleans, where David Duke almost became the governor of Louisiana. Now, for your listeners who don't know who David Duke was, he had been a member of the Ku Klux Klan and the American Nazi Party, and he won 67% of the white vote. And I would say, for me, this was sincerely a traumatic experience. And I began to think about a lot of things. Well, how could this happen in America? And that's when I began to read dozens of books about Reconstruction and ask various questions. And one of the great moments was for me to rediscover, as an adult, the legacy of Martin Luther King. He was an American essential. We had to have that person, just as we had to have Lincoln and Mark Twain and FDR. So I thought I could write a piece dedicated to his legacy, and it would also be a memory of my watching his funeral. So it is Eulogy for a Dream, and it could be subtitled Funeral Music for Martin Luther King. It's for orchestra and narrator who speaks the words of Martin Luther King.
We actually have a piece of a recording from that very composition right here.
I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. This is our hope. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood.
There it is, a piece of Eulogy for a Dream, composed by my guest, Maestro William Henry Curry. You know, when you compose for an orator like Dr. King, obviously he had cadences, and there were ways in which those preachers could create overtones and undertones in a room. How much of that were you aware of as you composed this piece?
I was trying to bring out the subtext of these words, or I should say the true meaning of these words. Again, you know, confidence is a good thing. When it came time for me to write music to underscore the I Have a Dream speech, fortunately I was in a zone, because otherwise you would just be crippled with anxiety and lack of self-confidence. But I was in the middle of a midlife crisis when I wrote this piece, and his words healed me. And even today when I hear this, I think how much they have helped me to become a better person.
You know, one of the great concerns and worries is that Dr. King has become pretty flattened out in the retelling of history, and that the revolutionary quality, the radical quality of his teaching, both the healing qualities, but also the prophetic call to action and change, have been lost in the retelling of his story. Do you think it's kind of up to artists to refresh and remind us what that stuff
You're
was
right.
About?
He's become a marble monument.
Yeah.
Did he actually exist? You know, it's a day off from school. Yes, artists can help. Journalists can help. People like you can help. It's important because unless you understand, you know, I feel that what did Gore Vidal say? The United States of amnesia.
Mm.
We must learn from our. We must know our history, and then we must learn from it. You can't understand race relations and problems in Ferguson if you're just 15 years old. And you know nothing about how that began 400 years ago.
What are some of your most memorable moments? We talked about you being in front of some 40 orchestras around the world, 19 years here in North Carolina. Some memorable moments for you.
One of the great experiences was with the Durham Symphony. I was doing a dress rehearsal of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, and it wasn't going well. And Maestro Curry lost his temper and threw the baton down. And I said, put your instruments down. You don't know what this piece is about. And I began to tell them what Beethoven was going through when he wrote this piece. You know, Beethoven had been a social person, very gregarious. And then one day, my hearing, something's wrong. And then he wrote this harrowing document called the Heiligenstadt Testament, which was actually a letter to his brother, which he never mailed. And in it, he talks about, I'm embarrassed about this. And by the way, how could God do this to me? Me, the worthy successor to Haydn and Mozart. And I'm thinking of killing myself because I just cannot endure this. And through this letter, he works things out and says, I'm not going to end my life because God has given me this talent and I am going to do something with it. And he said, I'm going to seize fate by the throat. And that's the meaning of the beginning of the Fifth Symphony. Taking charge of your life. And then the piece is filled with gloom and despair. And at the end, there's this incredible triumph over one's own agony and personal existence. And you begin to reach every person on earth with this majestic C major music. So this spontaneous rant by Beethoven, they listened to it. The next day, they came on stage, fangs bared, backs off the chair, and they took the piece away from me. I mean, I couldn't lift my hand above my head because the room might explode. It was, and unfortunately, the media, even the reviewer, wow, noticed that this was one of those rare occasions where it was more than music. So that, to me, was why I wanted to be a musician in the first place.
You also talked about the fact that that outreach is important to you. It was something that was being done in Atlanta, and it was something that you wanted to bring to Durham as well. Is that right, in North Carolina State?
In fact, I was offered the same week I was offered a job with the North Carolina Symphony, I was offered a job as associate conductor of the Atlanta Symphony. And of course, I had all kinds of ideas about this time of reaching into the black community and underserved groups and people that didn't even like classical music. I want to bring these people into concerts. And so I took this job because the orchestra and I had an incredible bond and chemical kind of reaction to each other. And I have tried to champion the music of American composers. This is something that American orchestras don't do very often. Now, that seems incredible. But most of our music directors are not American. They don't grow up with American music. They do not respect American music. And so I never forget seeing a chamber music concert where they played a Haydn quartet, a Beethoven quartet, and a Shostakovich quartet. Then he did a quartet by Wynton Marsalis based on jazz. That stole the show. This was a very sophisticated string quartet audience. You know, they don't need visuals like opera or cymbals like an orchestral crowd. And that taught me something, that Americans feel this music. And if, we like the term third stream music. This is music, this is a term coined by Gunther Schuller that talks about music that is a combination of classical music techniques and jazz and pop and hip hop and all that. And I've been, and with the Durham Symphony particularly, I've been trying to freshen our audience by doing this kind of music, and it really works, and they love it.
Is there a way that that audience, you talked about musicians shying away from or not respecting, and sometimes artistic directors, music directors not respecting American, but what about audiences? I mean, is there a certain sense of exoticism there? If it's American, it's not good enough. All those European artists, they're the composers we should be listening to.
There's a real problem there.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, the great thing about pop is people are always saying, what's new? The bad thing about classical music, what's old?
Mm, right.
What has been sanctified, and this is in the pantheon, and someone else has told me this is great and good for you. Most people that go to a classical music performance want to hear something they already know. But if you bring them something that they should know, that is wonderful. then they will appreciate that on the spot. But as far as the marketing departments for these shows, they'll say, well, you can't do that. Well, yeah, but they'll love it when they get there. But how are you going to get them there? Mm-hmm. Because only Beethoven and Mozart gets them there. So it's this eternal conflict between commerce and culture.
Maestro William Henry Curry, my guest today on The State of Things. Talking about his career, 19 years with the North Carolina Symphony. I guess the mixed program is the way to do that. You put the greatest hits on top and then slide in something from one of the Marsalis boys. And, things heat up because those guys in particular, Branford, what a treasure to have him in this area.
Indeed.
Understands that music is music and people will appreciate it if it's well done.
Right. Exactly.
And what about the commitment to the arts? I mean, that's one of the things that's been noteworthy here in North Carolina, particularly as a southern state. Its long-standing commitment to both art, graphic art, but music as well. The North Carolina Symphony goes back to the 40s, and it goes all around the state promoting this kind of culture.
Well, I'm so proud of the education concerts I've done all over America for the last 40 years. And I feel like a musical missionary, particularly with the North Carolina Symphony. I've done hundreds of these concerts free for third, fourth, and fifth graders mainly. It's an honor. And again, my hero is Leonard Bernstein, who would talk to these children as if they were equals. And of course, they are equals. They just don't know about Beethoven yet.
What keeps you going? You talked about having to remind the orchestra and the musicians that this stuff is still alive and still fresh. How about you? What keeps you fresh and keeps the music fresh for you?
The important to me at my age, and I'm 60 now, is to leave something behind. I love teaching. I taught at William Peace University last semester. I've mentored young people for 40 years. One of my favorites of all time is Jackson Cooper, who's a student at University of Greensboro. He's a sponge, and I feel that I will live on, the best of me will live on through him. I love discovering new pieces of music. I listen to every day a piece of music I've never heard before. I believe that there's still much more to discover, particularly in the 20th century repertoire. I'm lucky in that, and I don't know if this is answering your question or not, Frank, but my main blessing in life has been the love for music, and the second blessing has been somehow my enthusiasm is felt by the orchestra and through them to the audience. And that's why I've had a career. That's why people have hired me. That's why I've had contract after contract with the North Carolina Symphony. It's been a good marriage with this orchestra, and the audience loves to hear me talk. And somehow they sense my love through my music making for them.
We certainly have enjoyed listening to you talk for this past hour. And thank you so much for joining us, Maestro Curry.
My pleasure. Thank you, Frank.
Maestro William Henry Curry, the conductor of the Durham Symphony, the artistic director for the Rex Healthcare Summerfest Concert Series, and in his 19th year with the North Carolina Symphony. You can find out more about him and his music at thestateofthings.org website. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Wodarski's on the board today. Jess Clark is our intern. Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.